love. Welcome back to another episode of Conversations with Nova Reed. She's back. Have you missed me? I have missed you, and thank you for all of your messages, just checking in, and also just saying how much you've been missing the podcast over the past couple of weeks in this break on your walks and you know, your daily exercise. So it's great to hear that this is leaving such a mark on you, and also just how engrossed you are in these conversations and how they're inspiring you. That's, you know, that's why I do this, so it's great to hear. A huge thank you to those of you who have signed up to my Patreon to support. It is very much appreciated. So for the first time, I'm going to be able to outsource. The next three episodes will not be edited by me, hurrah, which will free me up to do the work that is so important and so urgent right now. So thank you so much. And if you're hearing about Patreon for the first time, you can click the link in the show notes to find out more about how you can support if you're learning something from these episodes, or if you just want to honour the work that I do in a way that is accessible to you, then a very, very small donation via Patreon is one way to do that, to keep these podcasts going, because I would like them to continue post-COVID. But in order for that to happen, there needs to be an editing and production team involved, because I have work to do. As you can see, the current climate is calling me to do the most urgent work that I've ever felt in my life. So how are you doing? Just check in with yourself. How are you feeling? How are you feeling in your body? It's been a lot. I have never felt more called to do this work. What you're hearing now is my dustbin man. This is real life. I have never felt, everything makes sense now. I now understand why everything has happened in my life, and that has brought me to this moment to be able to do this work, to be able to lead others in doing it, and to be able to contribute to much needed and urgent change. So thank you for being part of that journey, and choosing to be actively anti-racist with me. So yeah, it's been a lot. Last episode I recorded was in the middle of the trauma of George Floyd, and you know, it wasn't just the trauma of George. I think that's what sparked a catalyst. But you know, we were seeing things before. This isn't new for us in the Black community. This happens all the time. But in terms of things getting coverage in the mainstream, it was Ahmaud Arbery, it was Breonna Taylor. In the UK, it was Belly, the lady who worked for one of our train lines, Thames Link, when somebody who was infected with COVID spat in her face, and she died. And there's been many more. These are the ones that are coming to my mind in this moment. And then there was George, and the video circling around the internet for entertainment of our trauma. And that seemed to be, you know, that seemed to spark such a huge catalyst, which many of my colleagues who do anti-racism work are feeling really conflicted by. Because on the one hand, many of my colleagues, like Leila Saad, Rennie Edo Lodge, their books have sold out. Rennie is now the first Black British author to be to have her book as a bestseller. Leila Saad's book sold out. So you're seeing these really sort of contradictory feelings, because the publishing industry, and I will share more about my journey in the publishing industry soon, hint, hint. I have been writing a book since 2018, and I have had rejection after rejection after rejection. And in the early days, the feedback that I was getting from this book that I was writing was that, you know what, we're not really sure where we can place it. Not really sure that there's a market in the UK. And now we're seeing this tidal wave of people who are thirsty for work around race, racism, stories from Black writers, How to Be Actively Anti-Racist, in whatever form it comes, sold out everywhere. So again, you know, this is a very, very, very real example of what happens when industries are very homogenous. And the same thing happened in the film industry. So the publishing industry is about, you can Google it, I think it's about 92% white. And can you imagine if you're trying to tell stories of the black narrative and the people that you need to present those stories to are not like you, are not inclined to find out more about your world, have always been catered to as somebody who is white. Of course they're going to have a reaction, well, you know what, I don't know where this can fit in the market, and I'm not really sure, because you're used to having your race centred, and when it's not, it throws you off centre, it decenters you. Same happened with Black Panther. I remember vividly being very active on social media at the time and had a conversation with singer Lily Allen. I think her aunt works in film production, or at least she did. And remember, she was having this conversation on Twitter and sort of said, you know what, you know, now we're seeing the exponential sales and the proof that actually black does sell, it's not a put off. You know, the amount of times, I'm jumping around a bit because I'm just getting memories flooding in my mind back and forth. The amount of times when I worked in the, when I worked in the wedding industry more heavily with my business New Bride, which is all about celebrating underrepresented couples. So my bias was coming from the fact that I was a black British woman marrying a black trendy man, and we wanted modern style, elegance, class, luxury, and there was just nothing. It was like you were invisible as a black couple in the wedding industry, and it hasn't hugely improved. It's very, very behind. There have been slow steps, but the mainstream hasn't really improved, because those who are in the mainstream, who are making these decisions, again, are majority white people who feel uncomfortable about centering blackness. And I remember being in a meeting with a huge publisher, of a magazine, of a wedding magazine that is no longer trading. Happy to say, they didn't diversify, no longer trading, case in point example. And the editor had no problem, the editor at the time had no problem saying to me, but black doesn't sell. White women won't buy a magazine with a black girl on the front cover. Black is seen as risk. And all of these things, all of these opinions, all of these thoughts were memes that was passed down from editor to editor, from publisher to publisher, and a very small niche of people, of an industry that gives jobs to your mates. There was they had never, in their life history, this magazine, they had never used a dark-skinned black woman on the front cover of the magazine, and yet they kept saying it doesn't sell. Understand the irony of that. It's never been tried. But that's the belief system that gets passed on and passed on, and the belief systems aren't necessarily true. And so, you know, the same can be said for the literary world, the publishing world, and also Black Panther, I'm jumping around, that black won't sell, mainstream audiences, re white audiences, because black people, hopefully this is shifting, are not seen as mainstream, we're seen as other. Won't buy it, won't buy into it. You know, I remember there was a film called Precious, and those of you who are in my community will know that title of that film, and many of you won't. I remember I was it was many years ago, and I wanted to go and see it at my local cinema, which was in Hertfordshire at the time, and they weren't showing it. They were barely showing it. The film had people like Mariah Carey in it, because you know, majority black cast, it wasn't seen as mainstream. I couldn't find it anywhere. I think I had to go to London to watch it, and it was only in very few cinemas, urban in inverted speech quotes, that were showing it. Again, somebody in the high echelons of society deciding what we watch, deciding what stories have more value than others. And so when Black Panther came out and smashed box office records, Lily Allen was commenting, saying, you know what, my aunt was saying, you know, always struggled to push through stories that were different to those who were in decision-making roles. And, you know, how's it feeling now to eat your words, you know, to be proven wrong that actually, yeah, black really does sell and people want to hear different stories that are different to their own worldview. And actually, who are you to say that it's not going to sell based on your own belief systems and biases that are reinforced by your mates, because your industry is not representative of the worldview around you. And I can see a parallel with that in the publishing world. So it's this bittersweet of seeing this the momentum is unbelievable. As an anti-racism activist, I have never felt anything like it. So on the one side, there is part of me that just feels desperately, desperately sad and devastating that this momentum has had to come from seeing so much trauma on black bodies. Because why haven't you been listening before? Why haven't you believed us? Why haven't you seen, heard, or read about the accounts of this stuff that's been going on for decades and centuries before? Why has it taken all of this trauma for so many white people to wake up? That's the part that I struggle with. I also struggle with that my business, which at times I've needed to make a decision about whether I fold it or not because of cash flow troubles and lack of engagement, my business has seen a boost and a growth that I have never experienced. So then there's this conflict about, I hate the fact that my business is seeing growth in the middle of all this trauma. I hate that. I hate that. Equally, as an activist and seeing this movement and momentum of people who are open and ready to do this work and to be part of that tidal wave of change, exceptionally inspiring, and it gives me hope. So as always, as a human being, you know, I talk about yin and yang a lot. You can't have one without the other, and I'm just sort of leaning into both of those things. And I know that my colleagues are feeling the same conflict. But you know what it does mean is that I'm now more able to do more and have a wider reach, and to give back in ways that I haven't been able to before. So that's just a small update of where I am and where my head's at. And also, you know, this insatiable attitude, this insatiable feeling to get all of the information now, that's coming from a place of wanting to save and rescue. That's a very different place of, actually, I've just realised I am complicit in some way and I've got some unlearning and relearning to do. Let's go. So that we can really make sustainable and long-lasting change. The two types of people coming to me, one of these are those who want to save and rescue and to take pictures at Black Lives Matter protests and to do blackout squares. And the others are those who want to self-interrogate and figure out how they can raise socially conscious children and recognise that actually, I'm not going to get tips and tools on how to raise a socially conscious child unless I do the unlearning and relearning myself. So it's just, yeah, those are some observations I've made. And the same with businesses as well. So I just observe the behaviour and I'm now able to gauge when people are really keen to do this work, and the attention as to why they're doing it is very, very clear. The intention is, I want to be progressive. I want to be part of change because I want to reduce harm. And I believe in collective healing and equality for all versus, okay, we haven't done enough. I need to align myself with being seen to be doing more. More so than actually want to change the outcome sustainably. They come from two different places. And in sort of observing this in corporates, just in even in the language with the emails that are coming in my inbox, Those are, we're not doing enough, we haven't done enough. We want to be a leader and we want to be progressively anti-racist and we want this to form the culture of our organisation, not just in this movement, but ongoing. You know, we'd love to hear how, you know, you can add value and help us on this journey because we recognise we need help versus can you come in and teach us a one-off workshop on racism? Which one do you think is going to have long-lasting and sustainable change, and which one sounds more like a tick-box measuring exercise? This is what I'm dealing with. These kind of two camps that go on. So it's been really interesting, and I feel like there's also been there. You know, this episode is a bit of a jam with me on my own, and I'm going to introduce you to my podcast guest in a minute. But I feel like there's also been this wave of people just waking up for the first time, including some of my friends. And also those of you who are on my anti-racism course and you're now having to do the work in action, like your life depends on it. This is the work right now, having these difficult conversations with friends and family in your life who are all lives matter in, because there's a lot of that going on. This is enough now. You're feeling very uncomfortable about the fact that blackness, not even BAME, we've moved on from BAME because we recognise we don't lump each other in one group. It's problematic. That is making people very, very uncomfortable. Get curious as to why, especially if you're one of them. But what they're noticing is that there's a certain lady floating around the internet whose name shall remain nameless on my podcast, but if you know who I'm talking about, then you will know who I'm talking about. Black girl who supports Trump in America, and her reach is huge, enormous, and lots of people saying, well, you know, she's a black girl and she's saying this and we endorse what she's saying, so what's, you know, Black Lives Matter is a terrorist organization and saying all these inflammatory words, and you know, racism will end if black people just stop victim blaming and all of this stuff. And coming to me, so my students come to me and having to deal with these kinds of opinions, and they're like, how do I deal with this? Oh my god, Nova, I'm really, really now for the first time starting to get a glimpse of what it is that you have to contend with on a daily basis in as an anti-racism activist. And I can't thank you enough for your work. So those conversations with people in your life who matter are the hardest. Having the knowledge, education, tools, language, courage, confidence to address it and keep addressing it and keep addressing it without losing your mind is what really, you know, aside from campaigning and, you know, doing the bits that make sense, you know, writing to MPs, campaigning, donating to an extent, doing your own self-interrogation, part of the biggest impact that you can make being actively anti-racist and being an ally is having these difficult conversations with the people in your life who you love or you tolerate, who are quite happy to continue upholding white supremacy. And who treat black people as a monolith. They've seen one black person endorsing white supremacy, and they believe that you know, there's nothing for anyone to be protesting about as a result of that. So very interesting times, and it's really great to see so many more people joining this anti-racist journey and taking part in my online course so that they can feel equipped to be able to respond to this movement. Because you're not just going to get it from my Instagram squares or anybody's Instagram squares. It requires a multi-pronged approach. Learning, unlearning, self-inquiry, reading, learning about history, giving yourself the tools and language and skills to do this. And I'm really, really proud that I have a product that is ready to go. So again, if you're ready to be actively anti-racist, then I invite you to take part in my online course. Because it's helping people right now be incredible allies. And so I do want to give a shout out to those of you who are on my course who have been exceptional in your allyship in the past 2 weeks to me and the black community, and I'm not naming names, they don't do this for cookies, they do this because they care about humanity, and it's really evident. The digging in that they are doing right now is just really inspiring, and you know who you are. Keep showing up every damn day and ask yourself, what can I do to be a better ally today? Every damn day, without fail. Those of you who've particularly supported me in my grief, because I think people forget, I am an activist, I'm also a black woman and a human being, and I have been in my own grief and dealing with my own trauma being triggered, and the way you've been showing up for me, thank you. No tears today. So, without further ado, I wanted to bring a bit of testosterone onto the podcast. I thought it was about time. This is probably one of my most favourite episodes. I mean, I say that with all of them. They all bring me such a different amount of joy and energy, and just remind me of why I do the work that I do, and why I love connecting with different human beings. And so in this episode, I'm going to introduce you to my dad, Daddy Reed, who I fondly call him, or Papa, depending on my mood. And we're talking about my granddad coming over from the Windrush. We're talking about my dad's experience growing up as a black boy in London. We're talking about the apathy I had in terms of anti-racism work as a youngster. Yes, me as well. And my brother. We're talking about my wedding to an extent, friendship, martial arts, sort of overarching message of not giving up. I really hope you enjoy just eavesdropping on a conversation with my dad. You'll also notice that when I'm with him, I get a little bit more cockney. and a little bit more childlike. I really enjoyed this. My dad's well up for this. My dad has always been involved in anti-racism, always. And I don't want to share too much about the conversation to give in, but I remember there was just a turning point where I thought, it landed with me why he was so into it. It landed with me what was going on, the bigger picture, the systemic racism, and it landed. And so it's a real pleasure to bring my dad to you today. I hope you enjoy the conversation. Just eavesdrop, listen on in. And as ever, if it resonates with you, please leave a review. I will say this, though. The episode, it feels like the perfect timing, because when everything happened with George, the first people I think of are the black men in my life, including my dad. And my husband, who, you know, are my world. And it everything came up. It reminded me of just what my dad has to do to navigate being a black man in this world, in this current climate. And he was burgled in December. My family home was burgled. And it was quite profound, because I was there. I just recovered from a huge operation, and I was staying there because Mum's better at looking after me than my husband. We'll leave that conversation for another day. I love my husband, but Mum's a mother's nurturer and cookie. You can't beat it. So I was staying there for about a week, and I was just getting back to strength, getting back to feeling able to go back home for hubby to take over. And we just left, and my dad has driven me back to my home, and he drove back to his home, and it was burgled. So it was just quite profound, because it could have been a very different, if I was there at that point, I couldn't even sit up out of the bed on my own, and I just was feeling extremely vulnerable. Anyway, he got home to find the burglars in our bloody family home, upstairs having a whale of a time. And that entered and said, I know you're up there. I mean, there were some expletives, and he's going to be listening to this episode, so I won't repeat what he said. And get the hell out of my house right now. And in my family home, you have to come down the stairs in order to get out. There's no other way out. And he stood right there at the bottom of the stairs. There's three of them, and one of them had a knife. One or two of them had knives. And he stood there and he looked each of them in the eye. They were wearing balaclavas and he didn't flinch. And my dad is a highly trained, highly skilled martial artist. And he could have disarmed them and captured them. And in that split moment, he had to make a decision about whether to use his skill as a highly trained martial artist on these three intruders in his home. And what that would look like as a black man. And so he let them go. To this day, they've never been found. Those are the kinds of things that go on where you can't even defend yourself in your home because of the implications of what that will look like as a black man. Anyway, I really, really hope you enjoyed this episode. If it resonates with you, please leave a review. Over to Dad. Welcome back to another episode of Conversations with Nova Reed. I thought I'd change it up a bit today. I thought it was about time we had some testosterone on the podcast. So I have a very special guest with me today. Welcome, Daddy Reed. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much, Nova.
So I always start by asking my guests who they are beyond the roles that they play. So who are you?
Who I am? I just see myself as a husband and a father to my children, who I love very much and care about and be there for them all the time. That's how I see myself.
I'll take that, Dad. I'll take that. So where, I know this question, but the listeners don't. So where did you grow up? And what was that like being a little black boy?
I grew up in North London, Highgate. I initially was born in a place called Barber Street, which is Caledonian Road, which is behind Pentonville Prison.
Yeah.
So I initially grew up there. And then we moved to Highgate when I was very young. I'm not sure how old I was, probably about 3 or 4. So as you say, around that time, I was the only black family in the street at that time. And I was the only black child going into infant school at that time. So as a youngster, I don't recall much because at that time I seemed to have had fun. Although I was the only black child, I didn't think nothing of it. Mm. So at that particular time, when you're that young, you don't see things.
Yeah.
Until you get older. And I only started to see changes when I was in junior school, which was the same school. And I saw that I was being treated differently by certain people because of my colour. But certainly,
can you give some examples?
Pardon?
Can you give some examples, if you can remember?
The example was that I had noticed that the head teacher at the junior school always seemed to have been picking on me. People would always complain about me, although I hadn't done anything wrong, but she constantly blamed me and belittled me, although I was very young then. She used to embarrass me at school. So I noticed things like that. But at the time, I didn't think it was my colour. I thought that she just didn't like me. Plus the fact I found out later in life she was a magistrate as well. And apart from the odd name-calling that I did get, I mean, there wasn't a great deal of that, but I certainly noticed that I was being treated differently by this particular individual at the junior school. That's for sure.
Was there a defining moment when you realised that you were black?
I suppose there was, when people started calling me names, which they did do, and I didn't feel like I was part of the gang. I tried to fit in and didn't fit in, and I didn't know why. And it's not until I was verbally abused at the school by certain people, or there was favoritism. And then that's when I started to realise that I was different. But I didn't know why I was being treated differently. I mean, I was just another kid, but all the hurtful insults and that as a youngster affected you. So that's when I started noticing things, when I was actually starting to be verbally abused as a youngster.
And did it? How did it affect you? Did it make you lose confidence? Did it make you angry? Or how did that manifest?
It was more a loss of confidence than angry, because obviously I wanted to fit in, and I couldn't understand why I was being treated this way. What did I do wrong? And it got to the stage where, and you would have known this or heard this many, many times before, that I just didn't want to be black anymore.
Yeah.
And you got to a stage where I was trying to bleach my skin as a youngster. You know, and obviously, you just didn't want to be black. You wanted to be fitting, so you wanted to be white. Mm. And I went through that for a long time.
Oh, sorry, Dad.
That's all right.
Yeah, it resonates sadly.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, as you know.
Yeah.
And do you remember your parents? Did you talk to your parents about it? Can you remember?
No. The parents, you couldn't talk to them in those days about things like that, because they were probably, well, not probably, they were going through the same thing, but you wouldn't know that. And all they wanted to do is make a better life for themselves and their kids. So they never, ever talked about that. They just got on with their lives and dealt with things. So, no, I could never talk to my parents about that, because you couldn't, they're old school, so you just can't talk to them.
Yeah. But I have a memory, and it's not to say that Mum didn't do this, because I know that she did, but I have a strong memory of when I was going through those stages of not wanting to be black and wanting, I think it was powder that I used, wasn't it?
To try and make myself white.
Well, that was never going to work. but I remember several, I think it was, I was an early teenager, and I was just had desperately low self-worth, and I just hated myself, so much self-loathing. And I remember you doing, just building me up, telling me that I was beautiful and that, you know, my skin was beautiful. And I don't know if you remember that, but it's a strong memory I have.
Yes, I do. Yeah. And we did that because of what I went through. Me and Mum always said that we would make sure that our children could talk to us anytime about anything. We would not let you go through what we did, because our parents didn't know any better. It wasn't their fault.
All
they needed, it was all about just going to work and providing for the family, and that was the end of story. So me and Mum would make sure that that didn't happen. We would provide for you, but you would be able to talk to us. We wouldn't not want you to talk to us. And obviously what you went through is exactly what I went through, so we understood.
Yeah. And I felt that you understood. I felt that. So when did Granddad come over? He worked as an engineer, didn't he, when he came from the Caribbean in the Windrush? Am I right?
Yeah, he was an engineer. I'm not sure. He worked for British Telecom, which was Post Office Telephones then, as a driver. Now, I actually don't know whether he got that job after he came to this country in 1949, or he had jobs before. I actually don't know, because I only ever know him working in for the Post Office Telephones for all those years. But he wasn't an engineer as such. He was involved with the plumbing side of it, but he wasn't a professional in that way. He was just like a professional's mate.
But he responded to the call from the British government to come from the Caribbean.
Yes, he did.
From Jamaica and as part of the Windrush generation.
Yeah.
Did he ever talk to you about what that was like in later years? Just coming from Jamaica and trying to settle in a country that really didn't want them.
Actually, he didn't talk to me about it, but as you know, with the West Indian community then, there was always social gatherings. You know, you go to each other's house and play dominoes and drink, and then they'd have conversations. But he didn't have the conversation with me. I was just a young child then, but I would hear him having conversation with other adults, because obviously as a child you were seen and not heard in them days.
Yeah.
So he didn't personally have a conversation. He didn't have that conversation with me, actually. until I went back to Jamaica one time and we visited, and that conversation came up. But for all those years, no.
What did he say? Can you remember?
Well, he generally said he came over here, as everybody else has said, to make a better life and to bring his wife over, obviously my mum afterwards, for himself and for us as kids. So obviously he wanted to make sure that we had a better education and make sure that we didn't go through what he went through, which was obviously tough. But, you know, they, as black people, they congregated in England and they found friends somehow or other. But he didn't go into depth into it. I don't even know where he used to live or how he survived it. He's never talked about it, funny enough.
Yeah,
it's only bits and pieces I've picked, but he's never, ever talked about the in-depth what he went through, just little snippets. So, but then again, he was an ex-soldier, so he was very
private,
proud and disciplined man. And all he wanted to do is do what he needed to do for his family, and that was it. So, you know, my dad wasn't a person you could sit down and have a serious conversation with, because he just got on with life. He just did what he had to do.
I remember when, I don't know how old I was, younger, and Corey, my brother Corey and I, we used to, so dad is somebody that I talk about race with a lot, is, you know, reads some of the same books I do, sees this stuff, is aware of it, wants to dismantle it. And I remember, I can't remember what specifically was going on, but you were talking about race and racism. And I remember Corey and I rolling our eyes at the time, saying, oh, God, Dad, here you go again. Yeah, it's not that. It's not about race. And then suddenly I started to experience it for myself as an adult, what racism looks like in the 21st century. And there was this penny-dropping moment for me. I was like, wow, everything that Dad was saying is happening right now, and we didn't even realise it before.
No, you wouldn't do, because your kids are cocooned in your own little world. You have your friends, and you just get on with life. Which, you know, one, where are you going? Which one does? So you know, when I went on about it, and you rolled your eyes up, I thought, well, one day you guys will find out. You will find out, and it's how you deal with it, and it's how you deal with it. But you had your friends, you had your laughs, and like I did, and then racism just gets put to one side until it hits you in the face again.
Well, yeah. You can't. It's just, sadly, it's just a part of our lives.
Yeah,
I wish it wasn't, but it is.
Yeah, it is. But it's a case of when you notice it. And, well, you have.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So what do you think about me doing this work?
I'm proud of you. I am surprised that you've taken it to your heart. I mean, I thought if anybody was going to be like that, would be your brother Corey, because he's a bloody crusader for everything. I was shocked. And mum's always worried about you because of the offensive material you get. But, you seem to have taught yourself how to ride that storm. So I'm proud of you, more power to your elbow. You know, it's a tough road, but then again, a good road is never going to be an easy road.
Well, exactly. I don't even know. Well, I do know when I started leaning into it more, but I just felt called to do it, and I certainly won't do it forever. But at the moment, I feel I'm able to, and I see the changes in people that are open to having conversations and taking action. So, yeah, I didn't think I'd do it either, Dad. I was supposed to be a professional actress and dancer on stage.
Well, yeah, I mean, that just come out of nowhere, what you did. I mean, the thing is, you've done lots of things, so you're pretty rounded with stuff, and you've obviously found your calling for now, so that's all that matters at the end of the day. How one molds themselves.
Yes. what do I want to ask? What is this current circumstance? So this lockdown, this CV19 business, what's this teaching you about yourself and about the world?
Well, one thing I've picked up on it is it's certainly shown the good and the evil in people, that's for sure.
Yeah.
You know, you've got people now that are trying to help people, and neighbours who didn't know each other now talking to each other. Whether that will continue after this COVID is finished, I don't know, because human beings can be funny. But you've also got people that are now taking advantage of the situation by, you know, stealing and not caring about other people. I think the COVID thing is, I'm hoping it's going to teach people to look at themselves differently now, how they live their lives. You know, there's things that we're doing now, well, a lot of us are doing now, that we've never done before. We're learning how to survive in a different kind of a way. I'm hoping it's going to teach humanity, hold on a minute, that we've had a scare here. We've been carrying our lives in such a way, many people, not all of us, not caring about anything or anyone. And I'm hoping it's going to say, hold on a minute, you know, why did I do this? Why did I do that? I've lost somebody. I could have done this. Look at what my neighbours are doing. I'm hoping that people will become a lot more humane and less non-caring, shall we say. Whether that happens or not is another thing.
Well, remains to be seen.
Exactly.
Remains to be seen. What's it teaching you about yourself?
Me? It's not taught me that much, because I think I've been who I am. I've always been who I am, as much as I like to think I'm a person that cares about people and help people. It's taught me that I guess within myself that there can be some nasty things out there, and it just makes you look back and think, well, I'm still living and breathing. I need to thank God for that, and just continue to live my life as I always have been. Treat people right, as I like to think I have done. Have a laugh when you can. And just carry on doing what I've always been doing, to be quite honest. And just look out for people more.
Yeah, I think you've always done that.
Yeah.
On my wedding day, I say my, David and I's.
Yeah, he was. I remember.
Was he? My husband was very stressed. He did not enjoy our wedding day. David is he's the opposite of me. He's completely introverted, very private.
Yes, he is.
The whole idea of a wedding day, even saying vows, being in front of all these people was just a lot for him. But Dad didn't write speech. He just winged it.
Yeah.
And I remember you saying something about making sure that we're rich, being rich in life.
Correct, you can't remember that.
Not with money, but with the people that we surround ourselves with.
Yes.
Where was that coming from?
That's coming from friendships. That's coming from when you're being with a person that you're with, and you love the person you're with, that person is important to you. Being thankful for having a wife, a husband, a kid, a family and friends is a richness beyond compare, because a lot of people don't have friends or anybody to talk to or anybody to confide in. And so the richness of having people to be able to talk to and confide in is more important than anything else in the world, I think, because loneliness can be a terrible thing. So that's why if you're rich with friends and family, that's more important than anything else in this world, I think.
Yeah, that's such a lovely sentiment. And it's a reminder of it now, because we can't, obviously we can connect with technology, but it's not the same as being with each other.
No, it's not.
Yeah, and I really miss that at the moment, for sure.
Well, yeah, I mean, you said coming back to this COVID thing, that's the one thing we miss, not being able to see you guys and socialise with you guys. So that's a big empty void at the moment. Mm. But we'll rise above it and get through that again and just make the most of it like we always do,
eventually. Like we always do. So when... how long have you been an athletics coach?
I would say about 32 years.
What made you do that?
Well, that came out of the blue because, as you know, your brother used to play football and he wasn't very good at it. But one of the football managers came to me and said, listen, Corey's very fast runner. Have you thought about taking him to the athletics track? And, of course, I didn't know there was an athletics track. And he said, well, there's a one at Woodside. Take him there. So I took him there, got the information, took him there one Sunday. And I was just sitting by the bylines watching. And they made an announcement about people helping out to coach, assistant coaches and just helping them out. So I became a helper because I've always liked athletics and I thought, well, why not help out? And that's how I got started into it, and the rest is history.
Mm.
So
how does, Corey still holds the English national record for something, doesn't he? My brother, I laughed when my dad said my brother was rubbish at football because my brother is good at everything. So I'm relishing in that. But he still holds a national record for something in athletics, doesn't he?
As far as I know, he still holds the Watford District School's record for triple jump in two different ages. As far as I know, I don't think that's been beaten.
Over what period of time?
Oh, blimey. This would be going back to when he was 13/15, that age group.
Oh, wow.
So, yeah, work that out for yourself.
I'm not good at maths. So when you teach, you mostly teach, who do you teach, young people or adults? Or
both. I teach young people and adults over different days.
What does athletics do for the young people in terms of self-belief and confidence?
Well, I believe it does make them confident because I, as a coach, I try and always encourage them not to give up no matter what. You can't be the best at everything, but the fact is if you try and use that scenario at school as well, never give up, always try, you'll always find your goal in other things. But athletics is all about doing the best that you can. I don't care if you come last or if you come first, but finish, don't give up. And that's what I instill in the youngsters. And they're brilliant because they just go for it. And even better still, they encourage others, which is what I look for. I don't want them saying, oh, he's too slow or she's not good. They encourage each other, which is what I've always been trying to get them to do, and that's what they do.
Mm. So what is it that you've been doing it for 32 years now, so what is it that keeps you doing it?
The joy of their faces turning up each week.
You must be missing them now.
Yeah, I am a bit blessed them because there's some cheeky ones there, but I like them. The thing is that a lot of them are there because they want to be. They enjoy what they do. And it gets them away from tellies and phones and Game Boys and all that sort of stuff, even if it's for an hour. So the joy in their faces and the excitement in their faces, that's what keeps me going.
Yeah, bless. Right, where would you rather be? I'm going to give you some couple of quick questions. Beach or city?
Say that again. Miss that.
Beach or city?
Beach or city? Wow. I'd rather have both, to be quite honest.
That's greedy. One or the other?
Beach then, I guess. At my age.
Beef or chicken?
Chicken.
Plantain or saltfish?
Saltfish.
Yeah, no! What brings you joy?
My family.
How do you find calm in chaos?
Oh, that's a good question.
Yes.
Because sometimes I don't. Sometimes I don't. Sometimes I don't handle chaos very well, as Mum would testify to. The only way you can find calm in chaos is just to find a quiet spot somewhere and just lose yourself in that quiet spot if you can.
What do you mean by lose yourself?
Well, get away from the chaos. So, i.e. maybe I'll just put the telly on and watch something funny or something like that. Or disappear into the back garden or find something that cheers me up.
Okay. This is interesting because are you a second Dan black belt?
I'm a first Dan, but I've got a black belt in two different styles.
Okay, that's why I'm confused. Because martial arts itself, I think, is finding calm in chaos. Maybe you have a different interpretation of it.
Oh, but no, it did. Obviously, I haven't been doing it for years, but, I mean, certainly when I was training, yeah. No two ways about it.
Because it stopped now, but I started on a, for the listeners, I started on a, what am I doing, Dad? What's it called? I've forgotten now. Wing Chun. It's the only form of martial art that was founded by a woman. So it's not about strength. It's about technique.
And calmness.
Yeah. And the foundation of what they're teaching you, because my dad's done certain elements that I think cross over, is that the best thing you could do is to actually walk away and not fight. And I'm like, well, this doesn't make any sense. Why am I learning a martial art if they're telling me not to fight? So there's a huge amount around discipline. And when I first started, I shared with Dad, I felt so ridiculous. I couldn't do it. And I've done professional dance training before and lots of choreography. And I just couldn't do some very basic things. And there was one lesson in particular where I just shut down. They were trying to teach me something and I just completely shut down. I just couldn't do it. And the instructor stopped the entire class to talk me through because he could see what was happening. The more I couldn't do it, the more I was beating myself up. The more I was beating myself up, the more I couldn't do it. So there's a lot around mindset.
Correct.
And I wondered about the link between calm and chaos because you've got all these skills and these tools, but it requires a lot of discipline not to use them.
Yeah, it does. And it is all about discipline and respecting yourself and others.
Mm.
I think the one thing that martial arts did for me when I did start training and getting into it, it helped me to remember things more. It actually helped me a lot when I was at college because you then start to remember things and put things together. And obviously with martial arts, you're learning to do moves and you've got to remember the moves. But along that, you have to also understand what you're doing. And that helped me with college work as well. So not only was I just doing the work, I was understanding what I was doing. And martial arts certainly helped me with that.
How?
Hey?
How?
By thinking more, by analysing more, by working things out more. And being a lot calmer as well, actually.
Yeah. That's why I originally brought that up, because I do think that, well, certainly how they are teaching it, it's a lot about thinking, just being clever with it, really, and not reacting.
There is that. Sometimes there's it. Yeah, it depends what you're being taught sometimes, but as you say, it's not always a reaction. Not always. Sometimes it is, but not often.
So what was the one thing you learned from all those years of studying martial arts? What did it teach you about yourself?
It taught me that I was a stronger person than I thought I was. It told me that I was a more disciplined person than I thought I was, and it taught me not to give up, no matter how much the pain was, and there was a lot of that.
Yeah. But I've not got to the pain part yet, but it's really hard. It's easy to give up. It's really easy to give up.
And it's all about yourself at the end of the day.
Yeah, which I wasn't expecting. I was not expecting that.
There's many times I felt like giving up or not go to training, but then you sort of sit back and think about, well, what am I getting out of this? And once you realise what you're getting out of it, then off you go.
And you carry
until
on.
Until the next time.
Well, yeah. I remember that the particular learning opportunity when I was just shutting down, and I always do this. I no one else can beat me up the way that I beat myself up. And the instructor said, this is about self-compassion, Nova. You need more self-compassion for yourself. And I'm like, I've come here to learn about Wing Chun, not self-compassion. But it was very interesting that whatever lesson I needed to hear was what was coming up in those classes.
Yeah.
Around patience, trust in myself, and self-compassion.
Patience being the main thing. You have to be patient.
Which I'm not.
And believe, yeah. You've got to be patient and believe in yourself.
Yes.
And you just got to go through those barriers.
Mm.
And that makes you mentally tough.
Mm.
Because that's a great deal what martial arts is. It's about mental toughness and confidence. And you just got, like I said before, you just got to believe in yourself. And that's what you do. You believe in yourself, you carry on. You still there?
Yes, Dad. Don't forget that I'm recording audio.
Fair enough, sorry.
What's the world that you want for your grandson? What would you like the world to look like when he's my age?
I think in a real world, I would like him not to go through what we go through, the racism and the ignorance and that. I don't think that'll happen, sadly, but that's the main thing I would like. I would like him not to go through what we went through and to be treated with respect. And maybe the world forward will care about the planet and not themselves. And basically go back to the old days when we cared about each other.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that's what I would like for his world. Not a perfect world, obviously, because that never happened, but people caring about each other and helping each other.
More. Sounds good to me.
Yeah, but we shall see.
Anything else you want to say?
Apart from thanking you for this opportunity to talk. Not really. I can't think of anything else.
All right, then.
I can't think of anything else.
Well, that's good enough for me. Thank you for joining me today, Papa.
Oh, thank you, daughter, for inviting me to your specialised podcast.
I'll see you soon. Take care.
Okay, wish you well. Bye, sweetheart.
And there you have it, my lovelies. A chance to eavesdrop, well, a mini solo episode with me and an eavesdrop session with me and my dad. The overarching message there for me is self-compassion and not giving up. Doing the best we can so that generations that come after us don't have to endure what we did. So don't give up. If this episode resonates with you, please, please go back to your favourite podcast host and leave a review. Also, let me know what you think over on Nova Read Official. And great to be back again, and I'll see you soon. Take care.